young men had surrendered to the brutal challenge, rung the bell 3 times, the signal for DOR, or drop on request, and walked away from their dream of becoming a SEAL. They had quit. Hell Week was not a fitness test. While it did require some athletic ability, every student that survived the weeks of BUDS training prior to Hell Week had already demonstrated adequate fitness to graduate. It was not a physical test, but a mental one. Sometimes, the best athletes in the class didn't make it through Hell Week. Success resulted from determination and will, but also from innovation and communication with the team. Such training graduated men who were not only physically tough, but who could also outthink their adversary. Only a few years before, I had suffered through my own BUDS class Hell Week on this very beach. We began our Hell Week with 101 students. When we finished, only 40 of us remained. Some of the most gifted athletes in the class and loudest talking muscle heads had been first to quit. Those of us that had made it through realized we could push ourselves mentally and physically much farther than most ever thought possible, through the pain, misery, and exhaustion of days without sleep, precisely what Hell Week was designed to do. Now I wore the blue and gold shirt of a SEAL instructor. Following 2 combat deployments to Iraq, I was assigned to our Naval Special Warfare Training Center to instruct the Junior Officer Training Course, our officer leadership program. In addition to my day job, I supported Hell Week as an instructor. As the officer in charge of this Hell Week shift, my job was to oversee the crew of BUDS instructors who ran the training. The instructors were experts at their jobs of putting these students to the test. They were especially skilled at weeding out those who don't have what it takes to become a SEAL. For me, to observe Hell Week from the instructor perspective was a whole new experience. The BUD students were grouped into teams, boat crews, of 7 men established by height. Each 7-man boat crew was assigned an IBS, inflatable boat, small. An IBS was small by U.S. Navy terms, but awfully large and heavy when carried by hand. These large rubber boats, black with a painted yellow rim, weighed nearly 200 pounds and became heavier still when filled with water and sand. A relic from the Navy Frogmen underwater demolition team days of World War II, the dreaded boats had to be awkwardly carried everywhere, usually upon the heads of the 7 boat crew members struggling underneath. On land, the boat crews carried them up and over 20-feet-high sand berms and ran with them for miles along the beach. They carried them on the hard asphalt streets back and forth across Naval Amphibious Base Coronado, trying like hell to keep up with instructors leading the way. The boat crews even pushed, pulled, squeezed, and muscled the unwieldy boats through the ropes and over the telephone poles and walls of the notorious BUDS obstacle course. Out on the Pacific Ocean, the boat crews paddled their boats through the powerful crashing waves, often capsizing and scattering wet students and paddles across the beach like a storage shipwreck. These damned rubber boats were the source of a great deal of misery for the men assigned to them. Each boat had a Roman numeral painted in bright yellow on the front, indicating the boat crew number, all except the boat crew made up of the shortest men in the class, known as the Smurf crew. They had a bright blue Smurf painted on the bow of their boat. In each boat crew, the senior ranking man served as boat crew leader, responsible for receiving orders from the instructors and briefing, directing, and leading the other 6 members of the boat crew. The boat crew leader bore responsibility for the performance of his boat crew, and while each member of the boat crew had to perform, the boat crew leader, by his very position as leader, received the most scrutiny from the instructor staff. During SEAL training, and really throughout a SEAL's career, every evolution was a competition, a race, a fight, a contest. In BUDS, this point was driven home by the SEAL instructors, who constantly reminded the students it pays to be a winner. When racing as a boat crew during Hell Week, the winning boat crew's prize for victory was to sit out the next race, earning a few brief minutes of respite from the grueling, nonstop physical evolutions. They weren't allowed to sleep, but just to sit down and rest were especially precious commodities. While it paid to be a winner, this rule had a corollary. It really sucked to be a loser. Second place, in the instructor's vernacular, was simply the first loser. But bad performance, falling far behind the rest of the pack and coming in dead last, carried especially grueling penalties. Unwanted attention from the SEAL instructors who dished out additional punishing exercises on top of the already exhausting Hell Week evolutions. Meanwhile, the victorious boat crew celebrated by sitting out the next race and, most important, not getting wet and cold for a brief few minutes. The SEAL instructor cadre kept the students moving with constant boat crew races, giving detailed and intentionally complicated instructions to the boat crew leaders, who in turn briefed their men and executed the instructions as best they could in their exhausted state. The command went out from the SEAL instructor with a megaphone. Boat crew leaders report! The boat crew leaders left their boats and ran to take position, forming a smart line in front of the SEAL instructor, who laid out the specifics of the next race. Paddle your boats out to the surf zone, dump boat, paddle your boats down to the next beach marker, then paddle them back into the beach, up and over the berm and around the beach marker, then head carry back to the rope station, then over the berm and finish here, commanded the SEAL instructor. Got it? The boat crew leaders raced back and briefed their boat crews. Then the race began. In place of the traditional ready, set, go, the SEAL command to begin was stand by, bust 'em, and they were off. In every race, there were standout performers. Throughout this particular hell week, one boat crew dominated the competition, Boat Crew 2. They won or nearly won every single race. They pushed themselves hard every time, working in unison and operating as a team. Boat Crew 2 had a strong leader, and each of the individual boat crew members seemed highly motivated and performed well. They compensated for each other's weaknesses, helped each other, and took pride in winning, which had its rewards. After each victory, Boat Crew 2 enjoyed a few precious minutes of rest while the other boat crews toiled through the next race. Though Boat Crew 2 was still cold and exhausted, I saw smiles on most of their faces. They were performing exceptionally well, they were winning, and morale was high. Meanwhile, Boat Crew 6 was delivering a standout performance of a different kind. They placed dead last in virtually every race, often lagging far behind the rest of the class. Rather than working together as a team, the men were operating as individuals, furious and frustrated at their teammates. We heard them yelling and cursing at each other from some distance, accusing the others of not doing their part. Each boat crew member focused on his own individual pain and discomfort, and the boat crew leader was no exception. He certainly recognized they were underperforming, but likely, in his mind and that of his boat crew, no amount of effort could change that, and their horrific performance was the result. Boat Crew 6, you better start putting out, blared a SEAL instructor through his megaphone. Extra attention from the instructor staff had serious consequences. Our SEAL instructors were all over Boat Crew 6, dishing out punishment for their poor performance. As a result, the misery multiplied tenfold for Boat Crew 6. They were forced to sprint back and forth over the sand berm, down to the water to get wet and sandy, then bear crawl on blistered hands and feet. Next, they had to hold the boat at extended arm carry, with their arms fully extended overhead, supporting the full weight of the IBS until their shoulders were completely smoked. This punishment sapped every ounce of remaining strength from the already weary and demoralized boat crew. The boat crew leader, a young and inexperienced officer, was getting even more attention. As the leader, he bore the responsibility for his boat crew's poor performance, yet he seemed indifferent, as though fate had dealt him a poor hand, a team of underperformers who, no matter how hard he tried, simply could not get the job done. I kept my eye on the leader of Boat Crew 6. If he did not show substantial improvement in leadership ability, he would not graduate from the program. SEAL officers were expected to perform like everyone else, but more important, they were also expected to lead. So far, Boat Crew 6's leader was demonstrating performance that was subpar and unacceptable. Our senior SEAL Chief Petty Officer, the most experienced and highly respected non-commissioned officer of the SEAL instructor cadre, took a keen interest in Boat Crew 6 and their lackluster leader. "You had better take charge and square your boat away, sir," said Senior Chief to the Boat Crew 6 leader. Senior Chief was a Goliath of a man, with piercing eyes that instilled fear equally into terrorists on the battlefield and students in training. An exceptional and revered leader himself, he had mentored many young junior officers. Now, Senior Chief offered an interesting solution to Boat Crew 6's atrocious performance. "Let's swap out the boat crew leaders from the best and worst crews and see what happens," said Senior Chief. All other controls would remain the same. Heavy and awkward boats, manned by the same exhausted crews, cold water, gritty and chafing sand, wearied men competing in challenging races. Only a single individual, the leader, would change. Could it possibly make a difference, I wondered. The plan was quickly relayed to the other SEAL instructors. "Boat crew leaders from Boat Crews 2 and 6 report," blared the SEAL instructor through the megaphone. The two boat crew leaders ran over and stood at attention. "You two will swap positions and take charge of the other's boat crew. Boat Crew 6 leader, you're now the leader of Boat Crew 2. Boat crew 2 leader, you're now the leader of boat crew 6. Got it? Said the SEAL instructor. The boat crew leader from boat crew 2 was clearly not happy. I'm sure he hated to leave the team he had built and knew well. No doubt he was proud of their dominant performance. The new assignment to take charge of a poorly performing boat crew would be difficult and could potentially invite unwanted attention from the SEAL instructors. Still, he dared not try to argue the point with the instructor. With no choice, he accepted the challenging assignment with a look of determination. Boat Crew 6's leader was obviously elated. It was clear he felt that only by the luck of the draw and no fault of his own had he been assigned to the worst boat crew of underperformers. In his mind, no amount of effort on his part could make Boat Crew 6 better. Now, the SEAL instructor directed him to take over Boat Crew 2. His face revealed his inner conviction that justice was finally being done and his new assignment meant things would now be easy for him. Having received the direction to swap places, each boat crew leader went to his new position in the opposite boat crew and stood by for the next race. As before, boat crew leaders were given instructions, and they in turn briefed their teams. Stand by. Bust them, came the command, and they were off. We watched the boat crew sprint over the berm carrying their boats, then hurry down to the surf zone and into the dark water. They jumped into their boats and paddled furiously. Passing through the crashing waves, they dumped boat, got everyone back on board, and then paddled down the beach. The headlights from our instructor's vehicles caught the reflection of the yellow bands painted around the boat rims. We could no longer see the boat numbers. However, two boats were ahead of the pack, almost neck and neck, with one vying for the lead. A half mile down the beach, as the instructor trucks followed, the boat crews paddled back into shore. As the boat crews came in on the headlights, the numbers were clearly visible. Boat Crew 6 was in the lead and maintained first place all the way through the finish line, just ahead of Boat Crew 2. Boat Crew 6 had won the race. A miraculous turnaround had taken place. Boat Crew 6 had gone from last place to first. The Boat Crew members had begun to work together as a team and won. Boat Crew 2 still performed well, though they narrowly lost the race. They continued to challenge Boat Crew 6 for the lead in the follow-on races. And each of these boat crews outperformed all the rest, with Boat Crew 6 winning most of the races over the better part of the next hour. It was a shocking turn of events. Boat Crew 6, the same team in the same circumstances, only under new leadership, went from the worst boat crew in the class to the best. Gone was their cursing and frustration, and gone too was the constant scrutiny and individual attention they had received from the SEAL instructor staff. Had I not witnessed this amazing transformation, I might have doubted it. But it was a glaring, undeniable example of one of the most fundamental and important truths at the heart of extreme ownership. There are no bad teams, only bad leaders. How is it possible that switching a single individual, only the leader, had completely turned around the performance of an entire group? The answer, leadership is the single greatest factor in any team's performance. Whether a team succeeds or fails is all up to the leader. The leader's attitude sets the tone for the entire team. The leader drives performance or doesn't. And this applies not just to the most senior leader of an overall team, but to the junior leaders of teams within the team. I reflected back to my own experience as a boat crew leader in Buds through the tribulations of Hell Week, where I had failed and should have done better, and where I had succeeded. My boat crew at times had struggled to perform until I figured out that I had to put myself in the most difficult position at the front of the boat and lead. That required driving the boat crew members hard, harder than they thought they could go. I discovered that it was far more effective to focus their efforts not on the days to come or the far distant finish line they couldn't yet see, but instead on the physical goal immediately in front of them, the beach marker, landmark, or road sign 100 yards ahead. If we could execute with a monumental effort just to reach an immediate goal that everyone could see, we could then continue to the next visually attainable goal, and then the next. When pieced together, it meant our performance over time increased substantially, and eventually we crossed the finish line at the head of the pack. Looking back, I could have yelled a lot less and encouraged more. As a boat crew leader, I protected my boat crew from the instructor staff as much as I could. It was us versus them as I saw it. In protecting my boat crew, I actually sheltered a couple of perpetual underperformers who dragged the rest of the boat crew down. When Hell Week was over, talking to some of the other members of our boat crew, we realized we had carried along these mentally weak performers. They almost certainly would not have met the standards otherwise. That loyalty was misguided. If we wouldn't want to serve alongside our boat crew's weakest performers once we were all assigned to SEAL platoons and various SEAL teams, we had no right to force other SEALs to do so. The instructors were tasked with weeding out those without the determination and will to meet the high standards of performance. We had hindered that. Ultimately, how my boat crew performed was entirely on me. The concept that there were no bad teams, only bad leaders, was a difficult one to accept, but nevertheless, a crucial concept that leaders must fully understand and implement to enable them to most effectively lead a high-performance team. Leaders must accept total responsibility, own problems that inhibit performance, and develop solutions to those problems. A team could only deliver exceptional performance if a leader ensured the team worked together toward a focused goal and enforced high standards of performance, working to continuously improve. With a culture of extreme ownership within the team, every member of the team could contribute to this effort and ensure the highest levels of performance. Watching these events now unfold as a BUDS instructor, I knew that as difficult a challenge as Hell Week was for these students, it was only training. These young boat crew leaders could not fully comprehend the burden of leadership for which they would soon be responsible as SEAL officers on the battlefield. As combat leaders, the pressure on them would be immense, beyond their imagination. Only months before this very Hell Week, I had been a SEAL platoon commander in Ramadi, Iraq, leading combat missions into the most violent enemy-held areas of the city. We'd been in more firefights than I could count against a well-armed, experienced, and highly determined enemy. Death lurked around the corner at any moment. Every decision I and the leaders within our platoon and task unit made carried potentially mortal consequences. We had delivered a huge impact on the battlefield, killed hundreds of insurgents, and protected U.S. soldiers and Marines. I was proud of those triumphs. But we had also suffered immense tragedy with the loss of the first Navy SEAL killed in combat in Iraq, Mark Lee. Mark was an incredible teammate, an exceptional SEAL warrior with an amazing sense of humor that kept us laughing through the darkest of times. He was shot and killed in the midst of a furious firefight in one of the largest single battles fought by U.S. forces in South Central Ramadi. Mark was my friend and brother. I was his commander, ultimately responsible for his life. Yet I had received only a minor gunshot wound that day, while Mark was struck and killed instantly. I had come home, and he had not. This was devastating beyond measure. I grieve, too, for Mike Mansour, from Task Unit Bruiser's Delta Platoon, who, while not a member of my platoon, was also a friend and brother. Mike had jumped on a grenade to save three of his teammates. Mike was loved and respected by all who knew him. Like Mark, we deeply mourned his loss. On the same day Mark Lee had been killed, another beloved SEAL from Charlie Platoon, Ryan Job, had been shot in the face by an enemy sniper. He was gravely wounded, and we weren't sure he would live. Yet Ryan, tough as nails, had survived, although his wound left him permanently blind. Still, Ryan's drive and determination were unstoppable. He married the girl of his dreams, and after medically retiring from the Navy, enrolled in a college program and earned a business degree, graduating with a 4.0 GPA. Despite being blind, Ryan successfully reached the 14,410-foot summit of Mount Rainier and personally bagged a trophy bull elk using a rifle fitted with a specially designed scope with a camera for a spotter. Ryan was an exceptional SEAL, a wonderful teammate, and a friend who inspired all who knew him. Though he had as much right as anyone to be bitter about the hand life dealt him, he was not. We laughed continuously every time we got together. Ryan and his wife were expecting their first child, and he could hardly contain his excitement. But just when I thought that the men of Charlie Platoon and Task Unit Bruiser and their families who had suffered and endured so much were safe from the specter of death, Ryan Job died in recovery from a surgery to repair his combat wounds, wounds he had received under my charge. No words can fully describe the hammer blow that this news dealt, agony beyond comprehension. As their platoon commander, the loss of Mark and Ryan were a crushing burden that I would bear for the rest of my days. I knew that Mike's platoon commander and Delta Platoon felt the same way. And as commander of Task Unit Bruiser, Jocko carried this burden for all. And yet, as difficult as this was for me, I knew I could not ever fully comprehend how devastating the loss of these fine men was to their families and closest friends. In the months and years ahead, it was my duty to help them and support them as best I could. As I stood watching these young boat crew leaders, not yet SEALs, I knew they could not possibly grasp the responsibilities in store for them as future SEAL officers and combat leaders. Sure, Bud's training was tough. Hell Week was a kick in the nuts. But nobody was striving to kill them. Decisions in training here weren't life or death. Boku races did not lead to memorial services. There was no pressure that wrong decisions might spark an international incident, which could instantly make the evening news or front page newspaper headlines, with negative repercussions on the entire war effort, just as it had been for us in Iraq. When these inexperienced soon-to-be SEAL officers graduated from BUDS, I put them through our five-week-long junior officer training course, a program focused on their leadership development. I did my utmost to pass on to them everything I wish someone had taught me prior to leading in combat. In the final weeks of each course, we ran the Mark Lee and Mike Mansour Memorial Run, a five-mile uphill course that climbed to the top of the huge cliffs of Point Loma and finished at Fort Rosecrans National Cemetery, where both Mark and Mike are buried. In that serene setting overlooking the Pacific Ocean, most fitting for these two noble warriors, I gathered the class of junior officers around the headstones and told them about Mark and Mike. To me, it was deeply important to tell their stories so that the legacies of Mark Lee and Mike Mansour could carry on. It also served as a stark realization to these future SEAL combat leaders of just how immense their responsibilities were and how deadly serious the burden of command. As they went forth to serve as officers and leaders in SEAL platoons and beyond, all responsibility and accountability rested on their shoulders. If their platoons underperformed, it was up to them to solve problems, overcome obstacles, and get the team working together to accomplish the mission. Ultimately, they must fully accept that there truly are no bad teams, only bad leaders. Principle. About Face, The Odyssey of an American Warrior by Colonel David Hackworth, U.S. Army retired, influenced many frontline leaders in the SEAL teams and throughout the military. The lengthy memoir details Colonel Hackworth's military career, combat experiences in Korea and Vietnam, and his myriad of leadership lessons learned. Although a controversial figure later in life, Hackworth was an exceptional and highly respected battlefield leader. In the book, Hackworth relates the philosophy of his U.S. Army mentors who fought and defeated the Germans and Japanese in World War II. There are no bad units, only bad officers. This captures the essence of what extreme ownership is all about. This is a difficult and humbling concept for any leader to accept, but it is an essential mindset to building a high-performance winning team. When leaders who epitomize extreme ownership drive their teams to achieve a higher standard of performance, they must recognize that when it comes to standards as a leader, it's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate. When setting expectations, no matter what has been said or written, if substandard performance is accepted and no one is held accountable, if there are no consequences, that poor performance becomes the new standard. Therefore, leaders must enforce standards. Consequences for failing need not be immediately severe, but leaders must ensure that tasks are repeated until the higher expected standard is achieved. Leaders must push the standards in a way that encourages and enables the team to utilize extreme ownership. The leader must pull the different elements within the team together to support one another, with all focused exclusively on how to best accomplish the mission. One lesson from the BUDS boat crew leader example above is that most people, like Boat Crew 6, want to be part of a winning team. Yet, they often don't know how or simply need motivation and encouragement. Teams need a forcing function to get the different members working together to accomplish the mission, and that is what leadership is all about. Once a culture of extreme ownership is built into the team at every level, the entire team performs well, and performance continues to improve even when a strong leader is temporarily removed from the team. On the battlefield, preparation for potential casualties plays a critical role in a team's success if a key leader should go down. But life can throw any number of circumstances in the way of any business or team, and every team must have junior leaders ready to step up and temporarily take on the roles and responsibilities of their immediate bosses to carry on the team's mission and get the job done if and when the need arises. Leaders should never be satisfied. They must always strive to improve, and they must build that mindset into the team. They must face the facts through a realistic, brutally honest assessment of themselves and their team's performance. Identifying weaknesses, good leaders seek to strengthen them and come up with a plan to overcome challenges. The best teams anywhere, like the SEAL teams, are constantly looking to improve, add capability, and push the standards higher. It starts with the individual and spreads to each of the team members until this becomes the culture, the new standard. The recognition that there are no bad teams, only bad leaders, facilitates extreme ownership and enables leaders to build high-performance teams that dominate on any battlefield, literal or figurative. Application to business. I love this concept of extreme ownership, the CEO said. We could really use some at my company. We have a fairly solid team, but I have some key leaders that lack extreme ownership. I'd like to bring you in to work with us. The CEO and founder of a financial services company had observed a presentation I gave to a group of senior corporate executives. Intrigued by the concept of extreme ownership, he'd approached me afterward to engage in conversation. Happy to help, I replied. To better understand the dynamics of his team and the particular challenges of his company and industry, I spent some time with the CEO in discussions via phone, visited his company offices, and met with his leadership team. I then conducted a leadership program for the company's department heads and key leaders. The CEO opened the program and introduced me to those in the room, explaining why he had invested in this training. We aren't winning, the CEO stated plainly. A new product rollout the company had recently launched had not gone well, and the company's books were in the red. Now the company stood at a pivotal junction. We need to take on these concepts, like extreme ownership, which Leif is going to talk to you about today, so that we can get back on track and win. The CEO then left the room all to me, his senior managers, and department heads. After presenting some background on my combat experience and how the principle of extreme ownership was critical to the success of any team, I engaged the department heads and managers in discussion. How can you apply extreme ownership to your teams to succeed and help your company win? I asked. One of the company's key department leaders, the Chief Technology Officer, or CTO, who built the company's signature products, exhibited a defensive demeanor. He was not a fan of extreme ownership. I quickly recognized why. Since the new product line had been his baby, taking ownership of the disastrous rollout was humbling and difficult. The CTO was full of excuses for why his team had failed and for the resulting damage to the company's bottom line. He shamelessly blamed the failed new product rollout on a challenging market, an industry in flux, inexperienced personnel within his team, poor communication with the sales force, and lackluster customer service. He also blamed the company's senior executive team. The CTO refused to take ownership of mistakes or acknowledge that his team could perform better, though the CEO had made it clear they must all improve or the company might fold. I told the Buds Boat Crew leader story to the group, how Boat Crew 6 turned their performance around under new leadership, and I outlined the concept that there are no bad teams, only bad leaders. During my own training and performance in Buds as a boat crew leader, I told them, I can remember many times when my boat crew struggled. It was easy to make excuses for our team's performance and why it wasn't what it should have been. But I learned that good leaders don't make excuses. Instead, they figure out a way to get it done and win. What was the difference between the two leaders in the boat crew leader example? Asked one of the managers in charge of a critical team within the company. When Boat Crew 6 was failing under their original leader, I answered, that leader didn't seem to think it was possible for them to perform any better, and he certainly didn't think they could win. This negative attitude infected his entire boat crew. As is common in teams that are struggling, the original leader of Boat Crew 6 almost certainly justified his team's poor performance with any number of excuses. In his mind, the other boat crews were outperforming his own only because those leaders had been lucky enough to be assigned better crews. His attitude reflected victimization. Life dealt him and his boat crew leaders a disadvantage, which justified poor performance. As a result, his attitude prevented his team from looking inwardly at themselves and where they could improve. Finally, the leader and each member of Boat Crew 6 focused not on the mission, but on themselves, their own exhaustion, misery, and individual pain and suffering. Though the instructors demanded that they do better, Boat Crew 6 had become comfortable with substandard performance. Working under poor leadership and an unending cycle of blame, the team constantly failed. No one took ownership, assumed responsibility, or adopted a winning attitude. What did the new boat crew leader do differently? Asked another of the department heads. When the leader of Boat Crew 2 took charge of Boat Crew 6, he exhibited extreme ownership to the fullest, I explained. He faced the facts. He recognized and accepted that Boat Crew 6's performance was terrible, that they were losing and had to get better. He didn't blame anyone, nor did he make excuses to justify poor performance. He didn't wait for others to solve his boat crew's problems. His realistic assessment, Acknowledgement of failure and ownership of the problem were key to developing a plan to improve performance and ultimately win. Most important of all, he believed winning was possible. In a boat crew where winning seemed so far beyond reach, the belief that the team actually could improve and win was essential. I continued, the new leader of Boat Crew 6 focused his team on the mission. Rather than tolerate their bickering and infighting, he pulled the team together and focused their collective efforts on the single specific goal of winning the race. He established a new and higher standard of performance and accepted nothing less from the men in his boat crew. Why do you think Boat Crew 2, which had lost its strong leader, continued to perform well even with a far less capable leader from Boat Crew 6, asked another department leader? Extreme ownership, good leadership, is contagious, I answered. Boat Crew 2's original leader had instilled a culture of extreme ownership, of winning and how to win, in every individual. Boat Crew 2 had developed into a solid team of high-performing individuals. Each member demanded the highest performance from the others. Repetitive, exceptional performance became a habit. Each individual knew what they needed to do to win and did it. They no longer needed explicit direction from a leader. As a result, Boat Crew 2 continued to outperform virtually every other boat crew and vied with Boat Crew 6 for first place in nearly every race. I detailed how the original leader of Boat Crew 6 joined Boat Crew 2 thinking life would be easy for him. Instead, he had to seriously step up his game to keep up with such a high-performance team. For him, the greatest lesson of that day was learned. He witnessed a complete turnaround in the performance of his former team as he watched a new leader demonstrate that what seemed impossible was achievable through good leadership. Though he had failed to lead effectively to that point, the original leader of Boat Crew 6 learned and implemented that humbling lesson. Ultimately, he graduated from Bud's training and had a successful career in the SEAL teams. In summary, I told them, whether or not your team succeeds or fails is all on you. Extreme ownership is a concept to help you make the right decisions as a key leader so that you can win. The chief technology officer bristled. We are making the right decisions, he said. He was serious. Surprised at his statement, I responded, you've all admitted that as a company, you aren't winning. We may not be winning, said the CTO resolutely, but we're making the right decisions. If you aren't winning, I responded, then you aren't making the right decisions. The CTO was so sure he was right, so content to make excuses and shift blame for his own mistakes and failures that he made ludicrous claims to avoid taking any ownership or responsibility. Just like the original boat crew leader in Boat Crew 6, this CTO exhibited the opposite of extreme ownership. He took no meaningful action to improve his performance or push his team to improve. Worse, he refused to admit that his own performance was subpar and that he and his team could do better. His CEO had stated plainly that the company's performance must improve substantially, but the CTO was stuck in a cycle of blaming others and refused to take ownership or responsibility. He had become what a good friend from my own Bud's class and SEAL qualification training dubbed the tortured genius. By this, he did not mean the artist or musician who suffers from mental health issues, but in the context of ownership, no matter how obvious his or her failing or how valid the criticism, a tortured genius, in this sense, accepts zero responsibility for mistakes, makes excuses, and blames everyone else for their failings and those of their team. In their mind, the rest of the world just can't see or appreciate the genius in what they are doing. An individual with a tortured genius mindset can have catastrophic impact on a team's performance. After lengthy discussion with the department heads and managers, many of them came to understand and appreciate extreme ownership, but not the CTO. After the workshop concluded, I met with the company's CEO to debrief. How did things go? He asked. The workshop went well. Most of your department heads and key leaders took on board this concept of extreme ownership, I replied. You have one major issue, though. Let me guess, replied the CEO, my chief technology officer. Affirmative, I responded. He resisted the concept of extreme ownership at every turn. I had seen this before, both in the SEAL teams and with other client companies. In any group, there was always a small number of people who wanted to shirk responsibility. But this CTO was a particularly serious case. Your CTO might be one of the worst torture geniuses I have seen, I said. The CEO acknowledged that his CTO was a problem and that he was difficult to work with, and other department leaders in the company had major issues with him. But the CEO felt that because the CTO's experience level and knowledge were critical to the company, he couldn't possibly fire him. It also seemed the CTO felt he was above reproach.
I can't tell you to fire anyone, I responded. Those are decisions only you can make. But what I can tell you is this. When it comes to performance standards, it's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate. You have to drive your CTO to exercise extreme ownership, to acknowledge mistakes, stop blaming others, and lead his team to success. If you allow the status quo to persist, you can't expect to improve performance, and you can't expect to win. A week later, I followed up with a phone call to the CEO to see how his team was doing. Some folks are really embracing this concept of extreme ownership, he said enthusiastically, but the chief technology officer continues to be a problem. The CEO related how, upon my departure, the CTO had barged into his office and warned that the concept of extreme ownership had negative repercussions. This was laughable. There are no negative repercussions to extreme ownership, I said. There are only two types of leaders, effective and ineffective. Effective leaders that lead successful, high-performance teams exhibit extreme ownership. Anything else is simply ineffective. Anything else is bad leadership. The CTO's performance and the performance of his team illustrated this in Technicolor. His abrasiveness affected his entire team and other departments in the company that had difficulty working with him. The CEO understood. His company wasn't winning, and he cared too much about the company he had built and the livelihood of his other employees to allow the company to fail. They must do better. He let the CTO go. A new CTO came on board with a different attitude, a mindset of extreme ownership. With this change in the leadership of the company's technology team, other departments began to work together with success, and that teamwork played a key role as the company rebounded. Once failing and struggling to survive, the company was now back on a path toward profitability and growth. Their success illustrated once again that leadership is the most important thing on the battlefield. It is the single greatest factor in whether a team succeeds or fails. A leader must find a way to become effective and drive high performance within his or her team in order to win. Whether in SEAL training, in combat, on distant battlefields, in business, or in life, there are no bad teams, only bad leaders.
Chapter 3. Believe. Jocko Willink. Shark Base, Camp Ramadi, Iraq. Questioning the mission. This makes no sense, no sense at all, I thought, as I read through the mission statement from higher command. We were to execute missions by, with, and through Iraqi security forces. Unlike my first deployment to Iraq, where SEALs worked almost exclusively with our own SEAL team and other U.S. or NATO special operations unit, my SEAL task unit had now been directed to work with conventional forces, but not just any conventional forces, Iraqi conventional forces. The SEALs and Task Unit Bruiser were like a professional sports team, exceptionally well-trained to perform at the highest level. We knew each other so well that we could anticipate each other's thoughts and moves. We could recognize each other's silhouettes on patrol in the darkness. This was a result of years of training, not only in BUDS, the basic SEAL training course from which we had all graduated, but in the year-long training cycle that the entire task unit had gone through together. That workup consisted of training and practicing as a team, in desert, urban, and maritime environments, in vehicles, boats, planes, helicopters, and on foot. We had fired thousands of rounds through our vast arsenal of weapons until we could do so with the highest degree of accuracy while under substantial pressure. We had trained for hundreds of hours, iteration after iteration, drill after drill, until we could operate not just as a group of individuals, but as a team, a synchronized machine, maneuvering with precision and efficiency through the challenges of chaotic battlefields. As SEALs, we kept ourselves in peak physical condition so that we could execute tough missions and meet the extreme physical demands of combat. We did hundreds of pull-ups and push-ups, ran for miles, lifted heavy weights, swam long distances in the open ocean, all to prepare for combat. During our training cycle, in the precious few hours we didn't have a scheduled training evolution, we were in the gym physically pushing ourselves through punishing, high-intensity workouts. If there was no gym at our training location, we'd be out on the road for a hard run, in the parking lot dragging or flipping heavy tires, or on the mats in fierce grappling and jiu-jitsu contests. Whatever we could do to stay strong and conditioned. Each man was expected to maintain that high level of physical conditioning so that he could pull his weight and never falter on an operation. We had to be ready to carry a wounded comrade in full, heavy combat gear to safety across rugged terrain. As a critical part of our culture, we constantly challenge each other to tests of physical strength. We also had some of the best gear in the world. Encrypted radios, night vision goggles, infrared lasers, lights and markers, uniformed Kevlar vests and helmets. In the hands of operators who knew how to use this gear, the tactical advantage over the enemy was huge. Now I was being told the Task Unit Bruiser, my friends, my brothers, these highly trained and motivated men, would have to fight alongside conventional Iraqi army soldiers, arguably some of the worst combat troops in the world. Most Iraqi soldiers were poor, uneducated, untrained, undernourished, and unmotivated. With dire economic conditions across Iraq, many simply joined for a paycheck. When the going got tough, they often deserted, as we later witnessed. All of the soldiers had, to their credit, risked their lives to be part of the Iraqi army. Often their families were targeted by terrorists, their lives threatened while the soldier deployed to fight in a distant Iraqi city. Of course, there were some better soldiers among them, but the competent and capable Iraqi soldier was the rare exception, not the rule. The vast majority of soldiers in the Iraqi army, as fighting men, were far below the standard expected of any military, and certainly far below what was needed to take on and defeat Iraq's growing insurgency. Back in 2003,